Okay, so now dealing with the side of conditional, conditional religions based on faith. We dealt with karma. Now we're dealing with the gyan side, where then they're interested in extinguishing existence. So discuss Buddhism and Jainism, and now then we're going to the Western. A certain doctrine of extinction, similar to the Buddhism and Jainism, has been found preached in the continent of Europe. This doctrine is called pessimism. There's no distinction between pessimism and Buddhism, except in one aspect. Buddhism accepts the transmigration of the jiva soul. By observing the rules of extinction, the jiva soul attained nirvana and finally parinirvana. According to pessimism, there is no rebirth of the jiva soul. In this way, the doctrine of extinction is divided into two classes, namely, one, materialistic extinction pertaining to a single life, and two, materialistic extinction pertaining to multitudes of births. Okay. The Buddhism and Jainism belong to the second category. Both the doctrines agree with the rebirths. As per the Buddhism, after practicing kindness and abnegation for many births, the Bodhisattva finally became Buddha. According to their theory, a jiva soul will attain the state of parinirvana after observing politeness, patience, forgiveness, kindness, unselfishness, reasoning, abnegation, affection, etc. for many births. There will be no existence after parinirvana. In the ordinary state of nirvana, the jiva soul exists in the form of kindness. So there, it means the whole thing is you being nice and then you're going to get something. So technically speaking, even though this exists, the extinguishing of the soul is still based on being good. So that's why then they're put together in one sense. Is that there's still like a form of karma? You're performing karma, but you're being good, you're being nice, everything like that, and doing all these nice qualities. That will bring you to the state of nirvana. So the difficulty comes is that this will be a very hard process, because what is the inspiration? The only inspiration you could say for being good and nice is being freed from material existence. So the funny thing is you have to deal with the material existence and interact with it, but in a very nice way, despite its not being nice. So they're going through so much endeavor just to get rid of themselves. Right? So it's kind of strange. Well, the Vaishnava philosophy, then you're also doing the same thing, but you're being nice and good because that's the way Krishna wants you to deal with the material energy. So there's selflessness, dealing in proper qualities, so that proper qualities and dealing with the material nature is pleasing to him, therefore then you're freed from material existence. So you attain the same state of free from material existence, but you still maintain your individual identity, so that eternally one can be happy in association with the Lord. Well, this other is that having destroyed oneself, then, you know, at least in theory, then there will be, supposedly that's happiness, right? So you have to be not very pleased with the material world to think that that's going to work, right? So it's like a spiritual suicide. Jinnah's followers say that when a jiva practices all the virtuous qualities in subordination to kindness and abnegation, then it will attain accordingly the different stages of Nararatva, Mahadevatva, Vasudevatva, Parivasudevatva, Chakravartitva, and ultimately the Bhagavat under Nirvana. No, Bhagavatva under Nirvana. In both the doctrines, the phenomenal world is eternal. Karma is beginningless, but has its end. Since the worldly existence itself is miserable, the real bliss is attained by parinirvana, or the ultimate extinction of the sentience, of the soul. Jaimini's Vedic Karmavad is inauspicious for the jivas. Only the attainment of parinirvana is good for them. the gods like Indra. Okay, so this is what they're saying. So they're saying is this doing all this nice work, but for a fruitive purpose, this is not good for the living entity. So only coming to this point of self-extinction, that the jiva is actually benefited. The gods like Indra, etc., are the masters of karmavadis, and at the same time, they are the servants of nirvanavadis. Right. So here is that he makes a distinction that, how do you say? All these good qualities are in subordination to kindness and abnegation. So you're being kind to all other living entities, and you're being selfless. So the element there is that kindness, that's your basis of how the Lord deals with the living entities. So it's a natural position to deal with living entities. They're being dealt with by the Lord in that way. You're having to deal in this way. But the problem is still it's atheistic because they don't recognize that these qualities are all coming from the Lord. And this process is coming from the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? So, So it's a problem here. Schopenhauer and Hartmann are the materialistic extinctionalists of the first group. Right, so your pessimism that we're talking about, you know, the one life, single life pessimism. I mean, single life self-extinction and the multitude of birth self-extinction. As per the view of Schopenhauer, one will attain extinction by practicing desirelessness for existence, fasting, self-willing, abnegation, and humbleness, accepting of physical burdens, purity, etc. As per Hartmann, there is no need of observing any penance because extinction normally follows after death. Right? A person named Herr Benson has said that human suffering is eternal and therefore extinction of the self is an impossibility. So we always see is that there's going to be this element of that they're working on something higher and all that, but at the same time there's an underlying element of just gross sense gratification in that. So the one is saying be good, be nice, and then self-extinction will happen. The other one's saying why do you have to be so good and nice when you die, then it's all over anyway. why work so hard, right? It's going to happen anyway. So you can see in here that there's this common thread is there's an understanding of a certain basis of upliftment, right? It means if there's going to be some improvement, that is always through the practice of good qualities without desire for results, right? So this naishkarmya is the method of attaining liberation, right? It's always, no matter what school it's in, that element is going to be there. But unfortunately, none of these people understand its connection back to the Supreme Lord, right? So that puts them in the atheistic category. Now it can be said that among the prevailing monists, most of them are materialistic extinctionists. Materialistic extinctionalists. Those monists who aspire after the bliss of Brahmananda, after Nirvana, regarding their philosophy, it will be discussed later. So in other words, these are your materialistic extinctionalists that are dealing with just extinction of the soul. They're not interested in the Brahmananda. So we're not talking at this point impersonalists. It means these will all be counted as impersonalists, but they're not what we would call Brahmavadis, let's put it that way. Those, because everything up to now that has been discussed, all this is except for the karma mimamsa, like that, it's atheistic in that it doesn't believe in the Vedic, doesn't use Vedic philosophy, it doesn't use Vedic scriptures, right? Buddhists don't use it, Jains don't use it, the Western philosophers don't use it. Right, so Jaimini, only he uses it, but then he misuses it for that. The idea of the Vedic literature is a sense gratification. So this is a problem. Those who believe in the non-existence of the self after Nirvana, and who therefore do not accept any bliss after Nirvana, here we have called them as materialistic extinctionists. Right, just to put them in a particular category so you understand, because they're monists, but he's calling them materialistic extinctionalists. This materialistic extinctionalism is quite useless because it is quite uncertain about the entity of the jivas. If at all the jiva soul is a product of the matter, then it will be contained within the doctrine of the bliss of materialism. It is only atheism to say like this. If the jiva soul is an independent principle, then how it will have its extinction? Right, so if you're saying that the jiva is part of matter, then what's the need of going through all this anyway? If it's something separate, how can it be extinct? If it's part of matter, they're all saying it's either eternal, you know, no beginning and no end, or there's no beginning but there's an end. Does that make sense? Some will say there's no beginning, there's no end, therefore it means, in other words, the ones that are professing, happiness through fruitive endeavor, right? Means through good works. Ideally selfless, but as long as no one catches you at the selfish, it doesn't matter, right? They say there's no beginning and no end. So if there's no end to it, therefore then it is worthwhile putting your endeavor into it, right? These materialistic extinctionalists, then they say there's a beginning, there's no beginning, but there's an end. Right? So then if there's an end, then you can actually stop this material existence, and then supposedly in that state of nirvana, one will be happy. Right? Does that make sense? You know. So then you have a problem. If it is part of the material energy, then it will be it's actually connected to the the doctrine of materialism, in that material nature is there, and so it's part of that, so it's natural you just do good work and you'll get good results and you'll enjoy here. Do bad work, you'll get bad results. But if you say that no, it's not part of the nature, it's something separate, so therefore being separate and independent, it could be extinguished. But then the point is if it's independent, how can it be extinguished? Does this make any sense? If it's not part of the material nature, it's independent from that, then technically it's not involved with it. You know, right? There's just a thinking that there is, and so therefore if you act good and nice, then you can separate yourself from it and extinguish the nature of it. But the point is if it's independent of the material energy, because the whole point is that they're dealing with the material energy. But it's separate, so they're using material energy to extinguish the self, but it's independent from material energy. So how can, by being nice and good in connection with material energy, why would that extinguish the soul? And if you're saying that it's part of the material energy, then it's not independent, so it won't be extinguished anyway because the material nature lasts. You know what I'm saying? Because both of them are materialistic. It's based on your interaction with the material energy. Right? Being nice and being good. So it's still, all of them are fruitive on one side. They're doing that element. You know, so that's why they're all similar aspects of the same thing. But, you know, in their doctrine will be very different in whether the soul is there or not, whether it can be extinguished or not, whether it's eternal or not, all these different things. But one common point of all of them is two points. One is they all are based on some kind of faith, and the other is that they're all atheistic. Right? Does that make sense? Because they're all dealing in taking the conditional nature as the actual nature, and then from that conditional nature, then trying to uplift the self, but doing it through the conditional nature. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So they're using the principle of taking out a thorn with a thorn, but the idea is that it's based on interaction with the thorn. Right? So that,
The one using the thorn is an atheist.
No, but that's the difficulty. They can't explain these things. That's why I said it's based on faith. Because for all of these, there must be a kind of faith, because there's big, big holes in their philosophy, so there must be some kind of faith. You know, because their only experience is material nature, their whole process is based on material nature, but they're saying they're going to get something different than that as a result. That's like saying, I'm going to take rice and dal, and I'm going to cook it together, you know, using all good qualities and all, you know, detachment. And at the end, it won't be rice and dal. You know, so it's a problem, you know, these things. They're not well thought out. Okay. Okay, does that make sense? So if it's a product of the material nature, it's in contact with that. So if it's part of that, it'll remain. Because material nature is eternal, therefore the jiva will be eternal. And so eternally, then you can go on enjoying. Though Jaimini will understand that this and then say birth after birth, the other ones, it's not quite sure if they're saying like that. They generally have this idea that you'll go to this kind of like nice place. So there is an element of eternity, but it's all in connection with the material energy. Right? So then you can't separate, you couldn't extinguish the soul according to their doctrine. The other one you can, but the problem is it's based on its interaction with it, with the material nature to do that. But if it's independent, how will it be affected by it? If you can come to the platform near Fawn, be unaffected by material nature, how can the material nature, by dealing with it, extinguish the soul? Does that make any sense? Yeah. Also, where is the proof of such an extinction? Essentially, all these doctrines are quite godless. Since these doctrines were created for the purpose of controlling the evil attitudes of the materialists, they have been violently spread over due to the rigorousness and forceful mental culturing undertaken by the preachers of those doctrines. Right, so he's saying is that they're created to make the evil tendencies of human society into something nicer, right? But the interesting thing is how are they spread? They aren't spread nicely like they're talking about. They're spread by force, by violence, right? Means how you say, you know, the Ashok, then you had to be Buddhist, right? And then Shankara came and they just pushed them out. You had, from what I understood, I've heard is that, you've heard of these Naga Babas, right? These guys, they're naked with the big long mat, the hair, and they're pretty rough and ready. So they were like the, I don't know what you'd call them, but, you know, first the preachers would come in and present the philosophy. If people accepted and became Shankarites, great. If they didn't, then they brought in the Naga Babas, and then they dealt with everybody. Like that. So there was generally a tendency, you know, of these peace-loving people to either accept or leave. Like that. So so in all these is mentioned, it's just because it's violent, forceful, you know, like that. Due to the monarchy of Brahmins in India, and also due to their preachings of godless karma theory, the other castes, like Kshatriyas, had to feel oppression at their hands. As a result of which, the group of Kshatriyas subscribed to the doctrine of Buddhism, and the caste of Vaishyas subscribed to the doctrine of Jainism. Whenever a feeling of groupism is generated due to social enmity, it works so powerfully that the people engaged in it do their efforts for the cause of their own groups, without the reasoning of the right or wrong. The Buddhism and Jainism were preached in India under such circumstances. Due to the absence of developed religious reasoning, the people of many foreign lands accepted these doctrines as God-given. The materialistic extinctionists of modern Europe had preached this doctrine due to their enmity towards the religion of Christianity. This can be understood from the relevant history. Right, so, in other words, the Brahmins were acting, that means unnaturally putting themselves in the head of society, that it would be disturbing to the other members because they were not qualified. Therefore, they're being in that position, then they had to basically forcefully keep themselves in that position because people were pious and religious, they would tend to go along with this. But it resulted in the Kshatriyas therefore taking up Buddhism and the Vaishyas taking up Jainism. Right? And that you'll see common. This side you don't see it so much. Because over here, they're basically Shaktas. But if you go to the western side of India, and that in Gujarat and Rajasthan like that, then you'll see it is divided just like this. Basically, Jains are all business people, and the Buddhists on that side, they were all from Kshatriya stock.
Why were they Vaisya and Kshatriya not in agreement? Vaisya and Kshatriya, they had some problem, that's why they were full of different...
It means disagreement, I'm not clear.
Why didn't they both follow Jainism or Buddhism?
Just the nature of it, that was explained before. Because they were from those families also. It means Buddha was from a Kshatriya family, like that, and Jinnah was from a Vaishya family. So it was natural that it just spread in those communities, like that. You know, it's like the Jains before they become monks or like that, then they go get on an elephant, take all their wealth, because they're very wealthy, the Vaishyas, and distribute it all to the people. They just go down the street and give away everything to everyone on the street, you know, jewels, that, everything, all their wealth. You know, and then when at the end, and they, the guy didn't get off their elephant, and I guess shave their head and everything and move into the monastery. Like that. So it's, you know, so it has that element, that religion, that that leaning on the Vaishya, you know, the recognition and all that. Well, the other ones, they just leave. They just move to the monastery. Right? There's no hoopla there. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, now this is, I think, 14, verse 14. As per certain doctrines, an eternal potency called Maya has created the entire universe. This subtle natured Maya has created two different principles in the form of chit, sentience, and achit, matter. Due to the rise of Buddhism, when this doctrine of Maya had its declination, an effort was done for presenting it in different forms. In course of time, the Buddhism became associated with Tantra Shastra. Right? So now he's showing us how Buddhism, actually pure Buddhism, isn't being practiced by any Buddhist today. In fact, it was during the life of Buddha it stopped being followed as pure Buddhism. Because pure Buddhism, you have no home, no possessions, no anything. Right? You just live outside and wander. That's all you do. You just sit, discuss philosophy. Certain time of the day, you go begging. Whatever you get at that time, that's what you eat. And then the rest of the time is spent just discussing Buddhism or doing your meditation. That's it. So to have monasteries, to have rituals, to have all that, that's technically not from Buddhism. You mentioned here it came from the Tantra Shastra. So they picked it up from the Shaktas. Right? That's why their deity then is Shiva, you know, Parvati, and time. Like that, I think they call her Uma. Like that. As in, like that. That's actually where she got her name. Okay? Is that, yes, no? Okay. This tantric Buddhism remained in the name of Buddhism itself. But the non-Buddhistic people started subscribing to the doctrine of Mayavad, which is nothing but a concealed Buddhism. When this Mayavad had started being preached in mixture with the Vedic interpretations, the activities of Mayavadi Vaidika philosophers were initiated. In the mountainous regions like Assam, Kashmir, etc., this doctrine was preached in a different form by the preachers of Tantra Shastra, known as the doctrine of Maya Shakti, in loyalty to the Tantra Shastra, because these areas he mentioned was Assam and Kashmir, because these are where very large, the Kamakshi temple, Kamakshi, is it? Up in Assam, very big of all the Shakti temples. It's one of when Vishnu cut up Kali into pieces, and then the body fell all over the place, so different pieces fell, so pieces in Assam. Very big temple there, like that. So it's a big seat of this Shakta. And then up in Kashmir, there's also a very big, I can't remember the name of that, but very famous Durga temple up there. like that. So it's very, they're very well situated there. So those who are preaching in these areas, then keeping to their old background, preach the Mayavad philosophy or preach the Buddhist in relationship with this.
Right?
Seems to be. But I mean, Assam definitely. Assam, Bengal, this side definitely. There, then you get both, because they also have very old temples up in that area too, so you probably have mixed. But the point is there's a very big Shakta center of activities up there. Many people say that the tantric doctrine is an outcome of Kapila's philosophy, but in my view, it is not so. In the philosophy of Kapila, even though the prakriti, nature, is the crux, Purusha, or the counterperson of the nature, also has been accepted, who is unattached as a drop of water on the lotus leaf. This indicates the eternity of the sentient principle. In my view, the Shaiva doctrine is the outcome of Kapila's Shankya theory. Since nature, prakriti, is preeminently honored by the Shaiva doctrine, the ignorant people misidentify the same with the tantric doctrine. In the case of the tantric theory, even though the Purusha and Prakriti are often compared to the two halves of a gram, in the conclusion they denote that the Prakriti itself is the progenitress of the sentience. Right? So in other words, he's making a difference here between the Shaivism and the Shakti, the Tantra, is that in the Tantra, even though they accept the male and female principle, they say that the female principle is the source of the jiva, right? So that means material energy is the source of the jiva, like that. While in the Shaiva doctrine, you're dealing with Purusha, who is independent from the material energy, right? So they both have, so they're very similar, but the common person doesn't make this distinction. So Shaivites and the Tantrics basically are seen as the same thing. Right? So he's pointing out here. So he mentioning is Kapila's means in his Shankya, then there is the Purusha. So he's breaking down and analyzing material energy. So that will be similar to the Tantrics, because all they have is material energy. Therefore, by breaking it down, you have many things you can work with and do different things with. Does that make sense? But he's accepting Purusha, right? Well, here they're not. So it's not. He's saying it doesn't come from Kapila Muni's philosophy. And otherwise, they'll say it's coming from there. Atheistic Kapila, because Prabhupada talks about atheistic Kapila, then maybe connected there, but not with our Kapila, right? Does that make sense? Devahuti's son is not connected with him. A typical theory of the natural extinction of the jivas also has been imagined. No kind of theism is found in the doctrine of materialistic potency. Just as the followers of the transcendental potency submit their prayers to the absolute supreme Lord, the material potentialists, in ridicule of them, often express their prayer to the material potency. Staunchly atheistic von Holbach prays to the material potency that, O nature, O the empress of all the principles, O the piety and the truth, the twin children of nature, all of you be eternally enshrined as our protectors. Let all the human beings make praise of you, O the goddess of nature. Show us the path of happiness as intended by you. Drive away the oblivions of our minds. Disperse away the wickedness of our hearts. See that we will not be slipped from our footsteps in attaining the regular improvements in our activities. Let there be the kingdom of knowledge. Let goodness prevail in the souls and endow our hearts with peacefulness. The same naturalist, Holbach, has said that there is no soul, no God, and no world after death. The doctrine which contributes to the individual happiness must be honored. Right, the natural potency itself is the supreme principle. Right, so you can see a contradiction here. Is that what he's mentioning? Is that because what has to be understood is these people understand these principles or not? That's not actually what's important. The point is that human being must have, you know, this element of deity, right? And, you know, you perform an activity, you get a good result, right? So, therefore then, these things naturally come into play. So we see here, he's praying to a deity, the nature, protect us, help us, do all these different things, but at the same time, they're atheists, right? They don't believe in God, but they can deal with nature as if it's personified. You know what I'm saying? So that element comes. Otherwise, how is it that they'll function? How can they function? Right? It's very difficult. It's also interesting to note that Holbach was used to defeat other, materialistic, you know, persons. But then at the end, then he is also then brought to the front and thrown out. So it's a thorn with a thorn. Does that make sense? Just like in the Vedic philosophy, for basically most anything, then, you know, other than Vedanta, any other school than Vedanta, then karma mimamsa is used to defeat all the other four schools. So the four schools are defeated by mimamsa. Then Vedanta defeats mimamsa. Does that make sense? So here he's used these others, but they say this, but this one doesn't agree with it, right? Using them as an authority there. And then, after having done that, then shows that how they also have a problem, right? So they take it a little further than the other one, but it's still not far enough. In other words, a school that's farther than a less developed school can be used to defeat that school, right? But once that's defeated, then that has to be removed by something higher. Does that make sense? So it's just a method of, like you'll see, Prabhupada will be talking about the greatness of the Vedic culture, and even just what's left of it is so special. And then in that, he will quote and say, it has produced people like Gandhi and Vivekananda, you know, which are very influential in the world, you know, how you say, religion or philosophies or, you know, how you say, yeah, just all kinds of various movements that they will be there. But then when he gets down to discussing in India, then they're the first ones to go. Right, and then there's those who properly follow the Vedic culture, and then, you know, all the acharyas who base everything on shastra, on parampara. Then he'll have the four sampradayas and Shankara. So Shankara will be in that group to get rid of Vivekananda and Gandhi, which are just speculative. Right. Then after that, then it will be then the proper understanding of the Vedic literatures. Then is the four Vaishnava sampradayas and Shankara's out. Does that make sense? Like that. So, you know, it's just a matter of what is the particular perspective. But it's consistent because there's always the same consistency of who's in a higher position than another. Like that. Does that make sense? So like that. Okay. In the Mahanirvana Tantra, Lord Mahadev praises Goddess Kali as this. O goddess, before the creation, you alone were existent in the form of invisible darkness. All this universe has been generated from you by the will of the Supreme Lord. Here it can be decided that this tantra has been determined by the Shankya theory of unattached Purusha and active Prakriti. Again, it says that, at the end of universal cataclysm, you attain the form of darkness and remain alone, beyond the scope of thought and words. It is only you are the jiva in this world. You alone are the supreme goddess in the form of vidya. In this case, no distinction is seen between the sentient jiva soul and the natural potency. This is quite against the doctrine of Shankyavad. Right? Because Shankya then makes the distinction. So he's showing it's very close, but no distinction is made. That makes sense. We can understand this. You are the jiva in this world, because jiva is also used by Ramanuja. It means servant, right? So she is the servant in the world. Everybody else is serving her. But the problem is there will be how the wording of it. There'll be no distinction made. The material energy and the jiva are seen as non-different. So in other words, just as you have the Brahmavadis, that the jiva is Brahman and he merges in Brahman. So here, in the tantric, the jiva is and the material energy are non-different. So then, by proper behavior, then you basically become part of that. Does that make sense? Always the same formula. Otherwise, if it's confusing, how would people get involved? Something completely new. It wouldn't work. Does that make sense? So it's always within the realm of the formulas are basically the same. It's just you change the definitions. And, you know, or basically misunderstand the definitions. And so because of this, the, you know, being covered by the modes of nature, then all these different doctrines come up. That's why they're all considered conditional. Right? So in Shankhya, the soul and the material energy are separate. While here we can see is that they're not making that distinction. But we also see is that there's the will of the Supreme Lord. Okay, so because there is the Purusha and the Prakriti, right, then they'll say it's Shankhya. But then when it gets to this point about you are the Jiva, right, then they can understand that this isn't Shankhya because it also keeps the Jivas separate. Right? Because the philosophy is going to be based on what is the absolute, what is the nature of the Jiva, what is the nature of the material world, right? What is the process for elevation, you know, to perfection, and having attained perfection, how are you, you know, what's the nature of the Jiva? What's the position of the Jiva? Right? Does that make sense? So, according, that's how you understand the philosophy. So they're taking the material energy as the supreme, right? The Jiva is part of that. So the process is being good and nice and all those things like that. But at the end, it becomes so part of the material energy. So all there is Jiva and material energy, right? Or if they're accepting this thing of Purusha, but they're not involved with it. Even though they somehow their focus is still on the material energy. Even though they accept there's a higher principle, it's just kind of finessed. Right? So it's not really that the Jiva has relation with this Purusha. Right? Material energy may have, but the Jiva doesn't. So it still just comes down to material energy and the Jiva and the basic non-difference. Does that make sense? Right? Well, Shankhya then says that even if you're dealing with material energy, the Jiva is separate. Right? And after becoming freed from entanglement in the material energy, it will still be separate. Does that make sense? Like that. So therefore you can see it's though it's close, one can mistake it, it's different. Right? If there's a doubt on whether one philosophy and another are same or different, you just look at these 5 points. Right? Then you can always see what's the nature of it. Yeah? Okay, I'm not sure, is this another quote? This might be more quotes here. So long as the good and evil karma are not weakened, human beings will not attain salvation. Even the performance of tedious activities will not generate the real knowledge. Right? Because they're also pointing her out to be the real knowledge. She's the supreme goddess in the form of Vidya, right? So through knowledge, this tantra, you have this knowledge, then you'll become, you know, properly situated. But you're still that, what does that mean? If you're dealing with knowledge that is not connected with the Lord, right? Then it's ignorance, it's avidya. So she is that, yes, materialistic, she is materialistic knowledge. Because actual real knowledge is Divya Saraswati, is not of this world, is beyond. Then you're dealing, even though you're dealing with material knowledge as aparavidya, it will give you liberation. Right? Does that make sense? But here you're not seeing it in that connection, so then it becomes avidya or ignorance. Right? So that's why all these people don't do so well at the end of the day. They have all these philosophies, do all this nice work, but they don't really get a good situation from it. By the inquiry after reality and by means of dispassionate action, a sinless wise man will attain liberation. Muttering sacrifice and even hundreds of fastings will not bring about the liberation. Muttering. Okay, that means japa. Right, because they're chanting some you know mantra of this world or sacrifice or fastings. So their main thing is that knowledge and action without desire for result, that will free you from material energy. Right? Does that make sense? So we say the same thing. Difference is that they don't make the distinction so much. They don't know what is transcendental. They just know you get to a better position, but they don't actually, it's still within the realm of Maya. Make sense? So it's kind of a... Yeah. Knowing oneself as the very Brahman provides salvation. If human beings could get salvation by worshipping any imaginary deities, then very well one could have become a king, availing a kingdom in dream. The distinctions of the knowledge, knowable... Okay, he's making the point, is if you could get salvation by worshipping any imaginary deities, then in the same way, by imagining a kingdom in your dreams, you could become a king. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense. These others are imagining deities, and by worship of these deities, they are imagining that they'll get liberation. So he's saying that that same logic would mean if I imagine, you know, a kingdom and that I'm a king, that's what will actually, in reality, make me a king. Right? But it has nothing, so it has to do with action. So action has to be done, but if you want to be, in other words, you have desire for a result in this world, it will keep you here. You perform an activity that without desire for a result, that's not of this world, so that will get you out, that will get you liberated. But that means you have to have knowledge because you have to be able to distinguish. Does that make sense? The distinctions of the knowledge, knowable, and the knower, these are only the products of Maya. Okay, so he is breaking down that there's still this knowledge is that they're using our philosophy of Naishkarmya. But then they're saying that this knowledge that you're using is only a product of material energy, right? So while we see it as it's transcendental knowledge, because you're dealing with transcendence and it's his material energy. So our discussion about the material energy is in connection with the Supreme Lord that is his energy, right? So therefore it's not mundane, it's real knowledge. Right? But here they're saying is that all this knowledge that they're talking about, still that is coming from the material energy. Right? The knowledge, the knowable, and the knower are only products of Maya. Means I can be the knower, right? Then there's knowledge itself of what is knowable. But all this is just products of the material energy. So they're technically saying the jiva is a product of the material energy. True reasoning shows that only the Atman remains at the end. That person alone is the knower of the Atman, who has understood the knowledge as the transcendental Atman, knowable as to be spiritual, and the Atman as the perfect knower. All right, so he's showing that true reasoning shows that only the Atman remains at the end. That person alone is the knower of the Atman, who has understood the knowledge as the transcendental Atman, knower to be spiritual. So then the soul, then he is the one who is the knower, not the body. The body is material energy. The knowledge itself that they're getting here without knowledge of the Supreme Lord is material. The material energy that you're knowing is material, so that's all material. So unless one sees the soul as separate from this, then that will keep you in the material world. You see the soul as separate from this, then what they're saying is true. That will free you. But since they don't see the soul separate, it won't free them. Does that make sense? Yes? No? So you can see it still is coming down to the point, is it connected to the Lord or not? If it's connected to the Lord, then it will give you benefit. You'll get out of the material nature, you can get established in Krishna consciousness, right? So when you're dealing with material nature, if you see it in connection to the Lord, that will get you to the transcendental position. Right? Yes. Not really sure. He hasn't said here specifically like that. All of them, they're trying to be happy in some way. Everybody, all their philosophies are for being happy, right? But it's just a matter of how they're going about it, right? Do they have some faith in some, you know, coming in some particular line or like that, some religious system? Or we see like some of these European atheists, they've been disillusioned with, you know, the ritualism and the politics and all these other things that are obvious that they're not spiritual, you know, or not religious. And so then they just try to get down to the essence. And so they cut out God, cut out ritual and all this, though they create their own ritual, of course, you know. They cut out the prayers at the church, but then they make their own prayers. They don't use any of their deities, they make their own. So, but being frustrated with that, it comes up. So just like those frustrated with Catholicism then became Protestant. But then some of them who become disappointed with the religious process of Christianity then become these, you know, positivites or these pessimists. You know what I'm saying? So the positivism is that you go on, you just be good and nice, you'll get all good and you'll enjoy that way. And the pessimist means it's just, you know, you just do the same thing, but, you know, the soul become extinguished. Right? So one is looking for heavenly happiness and the other is looking for liberation. But basically they still follow the same principle, just without any other religion, without God, without like that, just dealing with material energy. Does that make sense? So you can see is the common point of all of them is they all deal with the material energy. And basically it is the supreme principle. Right? It's just the end result what you want. You become happy from dealing with it, or you'll become happy by, you know, extinguishing existence so you don't dealing with it. Yes?
I studied in a yoga from a half-tantric tradition. They said that tantra, the word tantra means liberation of energy. And so the idea is to, through, you know, their expansion of material energy, they kind of liberate themselves from it or something. It's like, even
yeah, well, that's why this is being discussed in this section. Because they're part of the materialistic, what do you call it? Extinguishites, what was that? What did he call them?
Extinctionists,
yes. Materialistic extinctionists. So they're part of that, but he's just showing that, you know, slightly different schools, slightly different branches of the same thing. And showing the distinctions between them so that one doesn't become confused. Because all of these things basically have to be gotten rid of. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
Just to confirm what you were saying about one school defeating another, you could confirm this. Basically, this these two schools which are looking for relief by liberation or enjoying heaven, heavenly types, could be defeated by Karma Mimamsa because you said they're not working properly even.
The difficulty is that you might be able to, these elements, because you're dealing with, specifically in the Vedic schools, the Kami Mamsa might deal them, but because they're dealing with liberation, he doesn't deal in that area so much. So you would tend to more use Shankara to defeat these guys. You know what I'm saying? If they're the materialists, what do you call it, that are trying to enjoy, right, that the happiness will come from proper, then Karma and Mimamsa can defeat their theories. Right? And if they're trying to extinguish existence, then Shankara would defeat them. Does that make sense? You know, because that's specifically what they would do. Jaimini defeated all the other philosophies, that's why then they were the prominent ones. The Brahmins were following it. But because of that, then the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas were becoming disheartened, and so they became Buddhist and Jains. Right? So then that was then defeated by Shankara. Right? So he dealt with the Karma Mimamsis, the Buddhist, Jains, any of those, he defeated all of them. Right? And then established, you know, the proper understanding of Vedic, you know, actual means, because all these others were, I mean, how you say? He brought it from that karma is not going to be the solution, that you have to go beyond, you have to go to Naishkarmya. Right? And then these others could relate to that, but then they were, how you say, not doing it through the Vedic processes. So then he established that you have to follow the Vedic processes. Okay, so in other words, following the Vedas, so you get rid of Buddhism, Jainism, and then the Karma Mimamsa is that, because that's Purva, you have to go to Uttara, which means that it's the latter, so Upanishadic view rather than that of the Brahmanas. Does that make sense? Because the Brahmanas are how to perform the Karmakanda activities, while the Upanishads are the philosophy of the Veda. Right? Does that make sense? So it's just a matter of which is more prominent. So he brought the prominence to Upanishads and Vedanta. Does that make sense? Yeah. But what we're meaning is that, let us say you're discussing, how you say, you're preaching, let's say, in a yoga studio, and someone brings up some, you know, somebody's idea of something. Now, if there's somebody in the yoga field, right, you know, whatever it happens to be, you know, then if they have something that counters that, because they accept that field, you would quote that person and defeat it. You know what I'm saying? Right? Having done that, then you would show the weaknesses there and then bring it to the proper Vaishnava standard. Right? Or if you have, or if you can, then you just directly use our own references. Or, you know, use Gita, use this and that. Why use these others? You know what I'm saying? Karma Mimamsa is used because he's done all the nice work and uses all the verses from the Veda. He's already done the work to defeat all these other schools. So since our purpose is to defeat these other schools based on the Vedic literatures, he's already done it, so we'll take his work. Not because he's Jaimini and his philosophy is bogus, therefore we won't work with it. No, it's he's done great work. Right? Like that. Problem is that he's only taken it to, he only up to the point of Purva, like that. While if you actually want to get do properly, you have to take it to the point of Uttara. Like Purva means the beginning, Uttara means the end. You understand? So he hasn't come to Vedanta, the end of knowledge. He is just using knowledge. You know what I'm saying? But his use of knowledge will defeat all the other branches of bogus philosophy. Does that make
sense? Is Jaimini, what, himself, he uses philosophy, or is he doing
it as a service? That you never know, like that. But it's a philosophy that people adhere to. So whether he, like Shankara, was just somebody who established this, or whether he actually was committed to it, that I'm not sure. Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.